Good morning, and welcome to the First Parish Church of Stowe and Acton, a welcoming Unitarian Universalist congregation. My name is Wiley Cordone, and I serve as co-chair of the Religious Education Committee. Child care is available during this service in the nursery in the lower level of Fellowship Hall, which can be reached by walking through either level of the connector building and then taking the elevator to the stairs. If the need arises any time during the service, please feel free to take your child there where she or he will be well cared for. If you're not sure where to go, one of the ushers will guide you. Everyone is invited to coffee hour in Fellowship Hall after the service. To get there, please exit the church through the door to my left, follow the hallway to the end, go down the stairs or take the elevator, and follow the arrow to Fellowship Hall. If this is your first time with us, we are very happy to have you here. Please sign one of our guest books, which are located in the vestibule at the front entrance of the church, at the new main entrance, or at the visitor's table at coffee hour, so we can put you on our mailing list. Thank you for your attention.
Community is so important to us that at this service, we began with an opportunity for you to greet your neighbor. I particularly invite you to reach out to anyone who may be new to you or may be visiting us for the first time and give them a hearty welcome. In the words of Psalm 133, how good it is, how lovely, those who gather here in true community. When we come together in community, we each bring a spark of the flame that burns within us to contribute to the flame that we light in our chalice as a community. As Mike lights our chalice this morning, I'd invite you to recite the unison words of candlelighting. Mike and Caitlin together light our chalice this morning. I invite you to recite the unison words of chalice lighting. Print it in your order of service. Candles, fire, and stars, these are the symbols of this most blessed of seasons. Candles for the banishing of darkness, fires to warm hearth and home, stars to beckon us, guiding our footsteps to the holiest.
In ancient times, candles were mounted on wagon wheels that were decorated with evergreens. They were lit during the dark weeks leading up to the winter solstice when the return of the light was celebrated. Christians adopted a similar tradition of lighting candles during the 4 weeks leading up to Christmas, celebrating the light that Jesus brought into the world. And so each Sunday, we light a candle for one of the messages of this Advent season. This morning, on the third Sunday of Advent, we relight the first candle, the candle of hope, the second candle, the candle of love, and the third candle we light this morning for peace. Peace in our hearts, peace in our communities, and peace among all people of the world.
Now we're going to light our Hanukkah menorah, or Hanukkah. I want to tell you about it first. It has 8 branches that are at the same height and one that goes up higher in the center. The central candle is called the shamus, or the helper candle, because it's used to light the others. The candles are lit every evening in Hanukkah to publicize the miracle of Hanukkah, that is, to make sure that people remember the story. Eileen is now, in a few minutes, going to tell you the story. Right now she's going to light our menorah shortly. Hanukkah is 8 days long, and each day another candle on the menorah is lit until all 8 are burning. And just as we read Hebrew, we start at the right and go to the left, we count the days and light the candles in the same way. Last night was the 7th night of Hanukkah, so Eileen will now light 7 candles, and as she does, the traditional blessing will be sung.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Eileen Gillespie. I'm the intern minister here at First Parish, and I wanted to share with you this morning a message for all ages about Hanukkah. So Hanukkah was one of my favorite holidays to celebrate growing up because my mother is Jewish, and I really enjoyed getting to light the menorah and hear the blessing this morning. Now, when we look at our menorah, like Tom said, it has 8 candles, all of the same height and one that's taller, and the taller candle in the middle is called the shamash. Can everybody say that? You'll need it later. The shamash. The shamash is the helper candle that you use to light all of the other candles. So we're going to learn about the story of Hanukkah. It is an ancient Jewish festival of lights and the celebration of a very amazing story. So more than 2,000 years ago, there was a very powerful king named Antiochus. That's a hard name. And he really did not like Jewish people. There were many Jewish people who lived where he lived. And because he was a very powerful king, he managed to hold them prisoner in their own land. King Antiochus had a big army, and they tried to destroy the Jewish religion. And they wanted to make the Jewish people join their religion, which at that point was the worship of Greek gods. So they wanted the Jewish people to convert to their religion. And with their big army, they took over the great city of Jerusalem, the holiest city of the Jews, and they ruined the holy temple there. This was where the Jews had their most sacred place. And so Antiochus and his army came into their temple. They turned over the candle holders. Think about if you came to church this morning and you saw that our place where we worship had been destroyed. You know, all the pews have no hymnals in them, and we've flipped over the chalice. That was what it was like for the Jews, because that was the place that they worshiped. And finally, the Jewish people could not take it anymore. And one of them, from their small group within the city, decided to fight back. He was named Judah Maccabee, and so he led his group called the Maccabees to fight Antiochus and his army. Now, King Antiochus had a very big army, much bigger than the Maccabees, but the Maccabees were very smart and clever and strong, and finally they won back the city of Jerusalem, and they freed the Jewish people. Well, when they finally got back to their temple, they were devastated to see that it had been destroyed, and the most important part of their temple was the light that was burning. In a synagogue, we have a light that we keep burning at all times to show the presence of God in that place. Well, the light was out, and they needed lamp oil, just like we use in our chalice, to keep that light burning. So they looked and they looked, and they finally found a tiny bit of oil to light their sacred lamp in their temple. But that light was always supposed to be burning all the time, and there was not enough oil for that. So with the tiny bit of oil, they lit the lamp, and Judah Maccabee sent some of his brothers to a nearby town to bring more oil for the lamp. But it was a long journey. It would take 8 days. And the Maccabees were hopeless. They thought, well, you know, we only have enough oil for one day. We'll light it. We'll see what happens. But it will go out before they return. Well, the light didn't go out. Miraculously, that light lasted for 8 days until the Maccabees were able to return with oil for the lamp. And so that's what this celebration of Hanukkah honors, is this miracle of light, the light that burned for 8 days until more oil arrived. And it's also the celebration of another great miracle, the freedom, the liberation of the Jewish people against the powerful army of Antiochus, and their regaining of their freedom to practice their religion. So the 8 days of Hanukkah observe these 8 days that the lamp stayed burning. And during Hanukkah, we eat foods that are cooked in oil to celebrate and remember this moment. So does anybody here like donuts? Yeah. I see some yeses up in the balcony. That's a special food that we eat on Hanukkah. And I don't think they do it at Dunkin' Donuts, but since I'm not from around here, we have Krispy Kreme where I'm from. I don't know if anybody here has been to one where you can see them make the donuts. You can see them go through the conveyor belt with the oil, so the donuts are cooked in oil. Another food that we eat on Hanukkah is latkes. Has anybody here tried that? Oh, yeah. Potato pancakes that are fried in oil. And so those are some of the ways that we honor this Hanukkah season. And what I would like to leave you with this morning, with this message about Hanukkah, remember what we talked about earlier about this helper candle in the middle. Who remembers what that was called? The shamash. My hope for all of us this morning is that we can be the shamash. We can be the helper to others. We can bring light to dark places. We can be the bearers of hope and leaders. So that's my hope for all of you this morning. Thank you for listening to this message.
Each week in our service, we provide you with an opportunity for generosity, not just to this church, but to another worthy charitable nonprofit organization, either local, national, or international, that has been selected to receive one half of the non-pledge offering for the month. For this month, that organization is Concord Prison Outreach. It's dedicated to providing services to inmates which help them to be successful upon release. Things like education, life skills, anger management, a whole array from gardening to bookbinding, I think. You know, an entire array of skills. They do need our support. Like most of the organizations we support them not only with our financial resources, but members of this church give of their time and talents as well. And that's particularly true for this organization. Several members of our church are active volunteers at the Concord Prison at this time. So the morning offering will now be gratefully accepted, both for the work of this church and for that worthy organization.
Bye.
Hanukkah is all about dispelling fear and finding courage to do the right thing. It's about piercing the darkness with light and not succumbing to those who would try to control us through acts of violence and oppression that are designed to make us respond from a place of fear. Simply put, Hanukkah tells us that we cannot be afraid of the dark. There are certainly parallels between the world of the Maccabee people more than 2,000 years ago and our world today. For those ancient Hebrew people, the enemy came from Syria. It was a brutal army that despised the Jewish religion and their way of life. And it gave Jews the choice either convert to the true religion of Syria or be killed, which at that time, their religion was the worship of the Greek gods. This is the time well before Muhammad and Islam. Many succumbed to the fear, but others did not. And miraculously, they defeated the forces of evil. The story of the great battle of Hanukkah is only really one part of the miracle, perhaps not the most important. The really miraculous part is probably that those people were able to hold on to who they were when it was trying to be taken away from them. They claimed anew their culture, their beliefs, their values. They kindled a lamp of hope in spite of the odds that that lamp might go out. Today, the fear-mongering enemy also comes from Syria, also claims a religious mandate. Their enemy is no longer just the Jews, but all of Western free culture. And rather than great armies showing their might on the battlefield, their weapon of fear is terrorism. And then as now, they only succeed if people succumb to the fear. For the past many years, especially since September 11th, attack of 2001, all of us have experienced a heightened sense of fear. Our lives have been punctuated with events that can put fear in us. With the recent terrorist attack in Paris and California, fear is coming close to home again, to the U.S., to our Western culture. Of course, we know that in other parts of the world, people live in great fear of just this sort of thing happening all the time. But we like to think, surely, not here. The French thinker and international relations expert, Dominique Moncey, claims that we in the West, Europe and the United States particularly, now actually live in a culture of fear. He sees this fear not just in isolated places, or with certain groups of people, but as the overwhelming, overriding emotional trait of our culture. Moreover, he sees this as a profound shift from the culture of confidence and hope that existed after World War II. If he's right, which I think he probably is, we have to consider the effect that fear is having upon us. It's not the first time in our nation's history that fear has been a defining characteristic in our society. On March 4th, 1933, in response to a severe economic depression and at a time when evil ideologies were taking hold in Europe, a new president taking the oath of office spoke these words to the nation. "Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself." It has a nice ring to it. And it did certainly inspire people at the time, but really it's not true. In our time, just as in Roosevelt's time, there are certainly more things to fear than just fear itself. But that statement makes a very important point, that being that fear itself can have a very negative effect on our society. In difficult times, Fear spreads rapidly from person to person, but not just only on its own. It is also intentionally propagated. Fear is used as a weapon. Today, it's the weapon of choice for terrorists. Terrorists succeed not by conquering with force, but by paralyzing people with fear. It's the weapon of choice for those who want to spread hate. Xenophobia and racism are based in fear and recruit supporters by appealing to people's fears. I'm afraid it's become the weapon of choice these days in politics. I'm very concerned right now in this election cycle what fear is doing to us. Today I want to examine with you the role that fear plays in our lives as individuals, as a community, and as a nation. If it's true that fear is increasingly dominating our lives, as I believe it is there an antidote or a way to move beyond our fears and reconnect with more positive forces, like those found in the stories of Hanukkah and Advent, things like hope and trust and faith? All of us live with fears, and they play an important role in how we lead our lives. On one hand, as little children, we learn to be afraid of the traffic and the hot stove and other dangerous situations. And we know that teaching our children to have appropriate fear responses to certain situations is a way of protecting them. Adults also need a certain amount of healthy fear. Reasonable fear causes us not to take unreasonable risks or act in reckless manner. When you drive your car, you do it in a certain way. You lock your doors at night. When you walk on the sidewalk and not in the middle of the road, in the traffic. These are fear-based responses, but they're most appropriate for our well-being. The point to start is that not all fear is bad, and we actually need a certain amount of it just to survive. But this morning I'm not focusing on the good kind of fear, but instead the destructive fear. The fear that holds us back as individuals and as a community. The fear that can steal our minds and cause us to make poor decisions in our own lives and even in the collective life of our nation. The fear that turns us against good people because of their religion or their race or where they come from or even what they wear. We have no shortage of fears. In addition to the collective societal fears, there are also the personal fears of things like illness or major changes in our lives. None of us are immune to fear at any level. But what we do with that fear, how we respond to it, will indeed have a great impact on the quality of our life. There are, I think, at least three responses that I believe we can have to fear. First, we can try just plain denial. Some of you have met my 10-year-old niece, Morgan, now 10. But when Morgan was a few years younger, she went through the princess phase. And at that time, she was addicted to the story of Snow White, in particular the video of Snow White. Well, we watched that movie over and over again. But when the witch appeared, she quickly blocked her eyes and yelled, "Uncle Tom, fast forward past the witch." She was afraid of the witch, and that was her way of dealing with the fear. That's the proverbial ostrich approach, or putting your head in the sand, so you can't see what it is you fear, and thereby convince yourself that it's gone away. Many of us, young and old and in between, often do try this route, at least maybe first when something happens. Denial at times can be our first response to fear, such as when you receive a bad medical diagnosis or when you should be seeing the handwriting on the wall at your place of employment or in your school. We can pretend there's nothing to fear and even fool ourselves for a short time. Now, on the other hand, we can become so consumed by our fears that they block our minds of thinking of almost anything else. And that leads us to the second response to fear, which is seeking safety at any price. In this approach, nothing else really matters, not our beliefs, not our values, not other people, nothing. On the personal level, it can be taking every conceivable precaution in some way, you know, never leaving your home or trying every conceivable treatment or cure anybody advocates on the internet if you have a particular condition. On a national level, I believe fear-based decision-making has taken us to some very troubling places. You see, when fear is the basis for our decision-making, we will exclude many of the other important considerations. Careful consideration of the effects of our actions tends to be lacking. Isn't that what we're seeing right now in the rhetoric of the presidential campaign? The 18th century philosopher Edmund Burke recognized the debilitating power that fear has on rational decision-making when he wrote, "No passion so effectually robs the mind of all its powers of acting and reasoning as fear does." It seems to me that we have gone through a period of fear-based decision-making. How else could you justify the adoption of a preemptive war strategy that resulted in the disaster that was the Iraq War, other than as a result of fear-based decision-making? There's no other way to understand the enactment of some of the extreme provisions that are in the Patriot Act that deprived individuals of fundamental rights with little to no evidence to justify such an intrusion, but as fear-based decision-making. It's fear that I think has led to actions that are not consistent with whom we really are as individuals and as a nation. Only in a culture dominated by fear would people who know in their hearts that torture is always wrong turn the other way when their government engages in it or when we send people to other countries to be tortured. And look, right now, we have a candidate advocating the return of waterboarding. In this presidential campaign, it seems to be fear that's carrying the day and resulting in candidates advocating shameful positions, contrary to every value we stand for. Refusing to let into our country mostly women and children refugees who've suffered great persecution and been thoroughly vetted for over years of time, governors trying to prevent them from coming into their state even though they have no authority to do so, presidential candidates advocating we refuse entry into this country of every Muslim, Congress refusing to ban even the most outrageous assault weapons and gun sales, especially of large automatic weapons, are now up nearly 20% since the California shooting of, what, a week and a half ago? If all we think about is safety, letting our fears rule the day, we will soon lose any high moral principles and beliefs that really define who we are. Of course, safety is important, and it's one of the duties of our government to provide for our safety. But as James Carroll wrote a few years ago, a longing for safety can be carried too far, and such a wish can be unworthily exploited by government. When fear so dominates our lives, such as safety becomes our only concern, we make very bad decisions. This is true in the life of our nation, it's true in the life of this community, and in each of our personal lives. But there is a third possible response to our fears, quite different from either denying it or totally being consumed by it. It's one of engagement with our fears and then transcending them. We're able to do this by connecting with a deeper and even more powerful force than fear. Essentially, we could call this the religious response to fear. Now, the connection between faith and fear, fear and religion, is an ancient one. Some religions are actually based on fear. Their response to fear would fall into the category of safety at all cost. But ours and many other faiths are not that way at all. Instead of manipulating us with fear to act in certain ways out of fear, they provide us with tools and encouragements to face our fears. Fundamentalists like to distort the essence of Western religious tradition by describing it, all of us, as God-fearing people. And although there certainly are references in both the Christian and Hebrew Bibles to fearing the Lord, Rabbi Mark Gelman says that the commandment that you heard so beautifully sung earlier, "Be not afraid," is in fact the most frequently repeated command in both Hebrew and Christian scripture. It appears 122 times in the Hebrew Bible. He counted, I didn't. And another couple of hundred times in the Christian Testament. This voice saying, "Be not afraid," comes to those biblical figures in times similar to ours, when fear is taking control of people. It comes in supernatural ways and it comes in ordinary ways. But it always does pretty much the same thing. First, it acknowledges the fear, it speaks its name, it looks it in the face. And then the voice reminds us that there is something better, something greater within us with which we can meet that fear. When your heart is full of fear, focus on higher things, values, principles, the things that all faiths teach. Especially in times of fear and despair, there is a voice inside us that speaks from a place of love and hope. We need to hear it. There's also something more to those biblical stories that are all about engaging with fear. Often God's voice or the voice of some angel tells the fearful biblical character to be not afraid, and it goes on to say, "I am with you." I suggest to you, no matter what your belief about the existence or power of a God, that statement is true for you. The I may be your neighbor, the person sitting next to you right now. It may be your inner strength and courage. It may be the forces of love and justice in the universe, or it may be God. However you see things, there is a countervailing presence in you that is ready to meet the fears that can overwhelm us. It's the voice that says, "The fears are real, but we can transcend them." And wasn't that the message the Maccabee people heard in the Hanukkah story? Living in these times of many fears is a spiritual challenge to us all. And I think transcending our fears is truly a spiritual journey that we all need to travel. How we deal with our fears is probably the single largest factor in determining the quality of our spiritual life. Sometimes engaging our fears seems like an impossible undertaking, but we can do so, not alone, but supported by other spiritual travelers and by the faith and trust we have in forces that are greater than fear. The price of either ignoring our fears or letting them rule our lives is just simply too high. We must engage them, but not let them control us. We have something to learn from our fears, but we cannot allow them to paralyze us or cause us to take actions that are unwise or inconsistent with our best selves. I began this sermon with the words of one great Roosevelt and will conclude with the words from another. Eleanor Roosevelt once said, "You gain strength, courage, and confidence by every experience in which you really stop to look fear in the face. You must do the thing you think you cannot do. The purpose of life, after all, is to live it. to taste experience to the utmost, to reach out eagerly and without fear to newer and richer experiences. That's what our future can hold. May it be so for each of us, for this community, and especially for our nation and for our world. Thank you.